In this episode, we finish up our coverage of the Barnes family murder on Russell Cave Road. You'll hear all the details about the murders, the aftermath, and the one surviving member of the family. Listener discretion advised. Hi, we're the Lexington Podcast.
We are all things Lexington, Kentucky.
History, true crime, current events, and local recommendations.
Glad you're here, y'all.
Lexington is historic and storied. It's no wonder that it has always had its fair share of baffling crimes. Some crimes are twisted and layered, and the press and the public can't help but fall into a sheer intoxication of every detail. Because whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, true crime is about the utter fascination with human nature. Suspects and victims become characters to us, characters in a book or a movie that you see glimpses of yourself in, that you know deeply on some level. Some crimes are almost born for the spotlight. The Bluegrass conspiracy that we covered in season one was about power, influence, corruption. The Turpin murder from season two was about love and lust and manipulation. And yes, all of those things make great TV. All of those things are inherently fascinating. But they make great TV, and the reason they're so fascinating is because we see a little of ourselves in all of it. Who hasn't been jealous? Who hasn't been manipulated? Who hasn't been in a power struggle? We don't have to agree to see. And we do see. We see ourselves reflected in a very vicarious way. We're quick to be vicarious. We're also quick to be appalled. Appalled by something that we can't see ourselves in at all. And that's the conclusion that I've come to as to why the 1973 Barnes family murder on Russell Cave Road never had the publicity that you'd expect it to. It never came close to the coverage of the Bluegrass conspiracy or the Turpin homicide. In fact, it's really hard to find any information on it at all. Some say that's because the one surviving member of the family was an intensely private person. Others say it's because the details were just so incredibly tragic. And yes, while it is incredibly tragic, I would argue that it didn't get as much coverage because the killer's motive was seemingly random. And random is frightening. This wasn't pre-planned. The family didn't end up being victims because of who they were as people or choices they made as individuals or who they married or who they ran around with that somehow, some way put them more in the path of demise. This wasn't about jealousy or getting even or even money, all the top motives of murder. This was a heinous home invasion gone terribly wrong, the definition of bad luck. These psychopaths could have picked any house on their way out of Lexington, even yours. Could as just as easily have been your family, your house, and no one, the press nor the public, wants to think about that. When we last left off, we met Wilmer Elvis Scott and William Sloan, and because their names are pretty similar, we're calling them Elvis and Sloan. Remember, Elvis is the ringleader, the one who masterminded the jailbreak from the downtown federal holdover building. And Sloan is the younger accomplice who saw an opportunity to escape and followed Elvis blindly by jumping out of the three-story building behind him to freedom on October 1st, 1973. Though they had not met prior to the escape, they didn't even know each other's names. They were suddenly partners in crime. Both men ran frantically in the same direction with no plan for what would happen next. They came upon the Sayre School and a long line of parents waiting in cars for their kids to come out of school. They forced their way into the first car in line. A driver was a woman named Geraldine Ewalt. She put up quite the fight with the convicts, but eventually was forced to succumb to their demands. They forced her to drive to her house at 1888 Charlbury Court, where they proceeded to tie both her and her children up. They stole what was of value to them, some knives, some money, and a shotgun. They took Miss Ewalt's car and left, miraculously, not harming anyone in the Ewalt family. But the next family would not be so lucky. Elvis and Sloan headed north, eventually making their way to Russell Cave Road, wanting to use it as an artery out of town. Just as Russell Cave is starting to look rural right outside New Circle, they came upon a beautifully secluded house at Route 3 Russell Cave Road. The Herald Leader described the 6,300 square foot house that sits on 3 acres as picturesque and, quote, "Though there are neighbors on horse farms within a quarter mile of the Barnes place, the trees are so situated that no other homes are visible from the Barnes home." Elvis and Sloan parked their stolen car in the back of the property and came in through an unlocked door. They found Francine Barnes, 18 years old, the eldest of the Barnes kids and the Barnes' only daughter, in the house, alone. She was a senior at the Sayers School, actually, kind of a connection there, an editor of Sayers' student newspaper called The Soothsayer. According to Elvis and Sloan, they came in and asked her if she was alone, and she replied yes, she was. They asked when she expected her parents to be back, and she said that her mother was out of town, but she expected her father and younger brother Johnny, who was at football practice, to be back very soon. Elvis and Sloan began locking all windows and doors to the house, finding and confiscating several weapons like shotguns and pistols and knives. They stashed those behind the couch in the living room. They also found beer and whiskey and wine, which they helped themselves to immediately. Here's Elvis's own account of what happened in his own words when he arrived. Quote, "So I shook down the house for guns and found 3 weapons, a .38 and a couple of rifles. So I took all the rifles and I put them behind the couch and I took the pistol. And so the man and the son came in a little later on. I don't even know how late it was. So I waited until they stepped through the door and I cocked the pistol and I told them that I was an escaped convict and I was trying to get away and I didn't want any trouble and I didn't want to hurt anyone and I made them sit down on the couch. Well, everything went along all right for a while, for a couple hours, and I told them when it got dark, I was going to take the car and leave. I said, I have to tie you up, but I said, I'm not going to harm you. I said, don't worry about it. So the man was sitting on the couch, and he got up, and he told me, and he said, I know you ain't going to harm nobody, and I've had enough of this. So I cocked a pistol, and I told him, I said, buddy, I'll hurt you. Don't make me hurt you. And he said, you got to hurt me. I've had enough of it. And he walked right up into the pistol, and so I shot him. Sloan was already in the bedroom to check the window to make sure nobody wasn't out front. And he came running in when he heard the shot. And I told him that the man was crazy because he tried to take the pistol. So it kind of shook Sloan up and he sat down on the couch. And the girl, she flew mad. You know, she come running over there and I really don't know what happened. Hell, I just went crazy and I shot them all. I took him in the bathroom and I laid him on the floor. I was so mad that I wasn't satisfied with what I got to thinking about it. I was insane at the time. I know that. I didn't feel like that they had been humiliated enough because I actually was polite with them. I was trying not to try nothing. And I took off her clothes and I went back out of the bathroom. I sat back down and then they got a call about 11:15 and I told Sloan we better get going. So we left." End quote. So that is a rambling. This is the part where we get to talk.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
I didn't make any notes.
No, it's all right. So that is a long, rambly.
He's so full of crap.
Confession. Oh, totally.
He's so full of crap.
Oh, absolutely. So what's going to be
retrospect,
really.
Retrospect. That was complete crap.
Yeah. And also what we're going to find, because I'm going to tell you.
Took off her clothes.
Because just to humiliate her. Yeah, no.
Oh, my God.
No, there's so much
more
to
this. He got drunk and lost his crap. You know?
Right. And also knew that he was originally locked up on a life sentence. Yeah. So this bout of, he's on borrowed time. Like he knows that like this is probably his last shot at free. I mean, he's squandering it, obviously.
It doesn't matter if they've seen his face. Face is probably on billboards already kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Here's the major plot points of what we do know had happened in the Barnes house based on the evidence. He shot Reverend Barnes in the foot.
The guy was a reverend?
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, he was a reverend. And that comes into play a little bit later on as well. He shoots Reverend Barnes in the foot at first. We know that that injury came first and had it Had he been left like that, he most likely would have survived. But then Elvis claims that Reverend Barnes said that he needed to be untied, because at this point, all three victims are tied up. And that
For a few hours now, right?
Yes, correct. And that he had a heart condition and that he started running his mouth. And so it was almost like it was the Reverend Barnes's fault that he ended up getting shot, because he was warned to be quiet and chose not to be quiet. Huh. Even though he's being held at gunpoint, he's still making a big thing about pissing off the people who have the gun, which is just complete and total BS.
And
in my opinion,
he gets up and walks and tries to intimidate someone with a bullet through his foot.
Exactly.
Probably not.
Exactly. So this is another quote from Elvis. He says, quote, "He," meaning Reverend Barnes, "sat there a while. And when he started running his jaws and getting smart, and I told him, I said, 'Mister, I'm nervous. I'm tired. I said, don't give me no trouble. Please just shut your mouth.' And he said, 'Well, I'm a preacher and I'll tell you.' And I said, 'You ain't no preacher. You ain't nothing.' I said, 'I'm supposed to be the scum of the earth and supposed to be sorry.' I said, 'God damn it. You've got whiskey in every goddamn icebox and shelf in this house, and beer in every icebox, wine. I said, you got a house full of guns. And I said, you're sitting there cussing like a sailor, and you're supposed to tell me that you're a minister.'" So he's saying all this to the police much later on, after that they've been caught. And that's sort of his reasoning for, like, well, I had to shoot him. Because he pissed me off. And I warned him not to, but he still went on pissing me off, so I had to. They tied up all three victims. A really sad little blip in the case file that I noticed is that there's two kids. Francine's the older one. She's 18.
And Johnny the football player.
Johnny the football player is 14. And of course, he comes in from football practice. That's where he had been, in his football uniform. He's found shot in his football uniform in the bathroom. Yeah. So they had shot them in various places in the house, but they dragged them all for some reason into the bathroom altogether. Huh. Johnny was actually also involved in karate. He had just recently earned his yellow belt. And when he was found, his hands were actually tied with his yellow belt.
Oh, my God.
Just incredibly sad. That's kind of my whole point in the beginning of this.
I really liked your excerpt there in the very beginning.
Oh, thanks.
But this is where I think you're wrong. It's like, we're drawn to tragedy, is what you were saying. How can you get more tragic than this? It checks all the boxes. It checks most of the boxes.
It does check most of the
children
boxes.
Children being murdered.
Sure.
Is a big box checked. People,
right.
You know what I mean? News loves that. And I'm sure this was a big deal in the news, but why hasn't there been large-scale documentaries that would at least include the Barnes family murders within their program? It seems very worthy.
It does, and it should have gotten... I'm on the fence with that, because it's like, you don't want to draw attention to something to make the surviving members of the family have to relive that over and over, especially when there was never any need to worry about the two killers. I'll tell you what happens to them. It's not like they were going to be out on like parole or something
right,
like that.
Right.
So, but at the same time, though, there needed to be attention drawn to that crime to give it the due respect in its own way that I think that it deserved.
It needs to have understanding.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
But there is no understanding. That's my point, is that
we should strive for it, right?
They picked that house so randomly, and it's really difficult to think about like how any night there could just be some psycho that busts through your door while you're waiting for your little brother to come home from football practice.
And if you say the wrong thing and then they're drunk.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrifying thought. I couldn't help but also think quite a bit about the fact that just recently there was another home invasion here in Kentucky, in Richmond, Kentucky, where this guy, young guy, 22 years old, busts into a very large
high profile
case, a very large mansion, which had a bomb shelter of sorts, like a fallout shelter. And the reasoning for that is because, in really wild case in the sense of, I know that there's a Russian-Ukrainian war going on, and this could be the end of the United States, these kind of doomsday prepper types.
Uh-huh.
And I know that there's this house that's been in the news that has a shelter that could potentially shield me from atomic bombs. And I'm going to go in and have a home invasion and just kind of blow the place up to be able to take that over. So if you haven't heard of that case, you feel free to look that up for our listeners. But I'm researching this as that case is also happening. And it's just wild to think about home invasions, because so many murders that get a lot of attention, it's because there's a love triangle. There's decisions that you have made because you've put yourself in the path of these sort of psychos or something.
Or it's money.
It's jealousy. It's all these main motives. But a really, really frightening thing to think about is the random home invasion. And that's why I think this one didn't get a lot of attention, because it was like, no. Lexington's still safe. This was one random occurrence. Let's not get wild here. Everybody's fine.
That's a
fine.
Whole different angle, homegirl. Yeah, that's a whole other angle.
I don't know.
And that's despicable to do that in a way. Yeah. Or is it good? I don't know. What would you want from your city and from your media? For them to be like Big Brother, try to help you not be as afraid? Or do you want the unadulterated truth?
I think I would want a holdover cell that was you're not able to break out of to begin with. How about that?
That's a pretty good request. Yeah.
And also maybe the fact that this was Elvis's second breakout.
Who is this guy?
He's a psycho. Okay, speaking of
an intelligent psycho.
All right. Here's another. I'm just going to go through the points of what I found in the case files. Tied all three victims up, like I told you. Francine's blood alcohol level during her autopsy was 0.19.
Damn!
So over double the legal limit. There was also evidence of rape. And
I was going to ask that.
Yeah. So
they were giving her that alcohol.
I think they were forcing her to have alcohol, for sure. And I'm sure a lot of that happened before the dad and the younger brother came in. But Johnny's blood alcohol was 0.0, and the dad's, Reverend Barnes, was like 0.04, so like 1 to 2 drinks. But Francine's was like well over double the legal limit, which is absolutely despicable.
What a terrible death.
All three were found in the bathroom. Johnny was still in his football uniform, and Francine was found nude. They left. So Elvis and Sloan left in Reverend Barnes's car about 11 p.m., which means they stayed in the Barnes house for over 6 hours. They headed north on Russell Cave, taking U.S. 27, and Sloan drove. Sloan actually did all the driving. He did the driving from the holdover, so like Sayre to the Ewalt's house, the Ewalt's to the Barnes's house, the Barnes to where they're headed next. He did all the driving, which is interesting. I don't know. He never actually says it. He just says, I did all the driving.
Is it possible that he was coerced for some of this?
Great question. And we're going to get to that here in just a second.
Oh.
They next drive to a sleepy roadside motel called Fisher's Motel in Falmouth, Kentucky, which is an hour north of Lexington. They busted into the office of the motel. Keep in mind, this is like in the middle of the night, sometime around 1 a.m., where they found midnight to 1. They found the night clerk, a guy named Elva Harper. So Elvis and Sloan rob the cash drawer and force Harper, the night clerk, to open a motel room so they could rob the people inside and possibly get a new getaway car. Harper did as he was told, and he opens rooms 5 and 6, where they find 2 men were sleeping in each room. So 2 men were sleeping in room 5, and 2 men were sleeping in room 6. The 4 of them are actually all coworkers. They're in that area on business with their company. They had been working in Falmouth for several weeks at this point, and they were actually just about to go home. Like, their job was about to be done. The 2 men that were sleeping in rooms 5, they both get shot, but miraculously survive. The 2 that were sleeping in room 6 also get shot, and they unfortunately died, as did Elva Harper, the hotel clerk.
They killed all of them?
They killed the 3 members of the Barnes family. Keep in mind, the mom was not in town.
Right.
And then they go to this motel
and kill all 5?
They kill 3 people there. So a total of 6 people. Dang. 3 from the Barnes and 3 from the motel. They shot 2 other men in that room number 5, but they didn't die.
They lived. Okay.
They lived, yeah.
Is there a transcript as to why they killed them?
They killed them because they wanted to.
Did Elvis have some interesting tidbits to tell us? Turd.
This is actually from a book which covers the case and does a pretty decent job covering the case, as far as I can tell, in terms of accuracy, for looking over the case files as well. It's by a guy named Kevin Sullivan, and it's in a book called Kentucky Bloodbath. This is on page 46. Quote, Elvis and Sloan then switched vehicles, this time stealing a car registered to the wife of Monroe Sizemore, which is one of the men in those hotel rooms. The 2 continued driving north on US 27 But a little bit before 2 a.m., they were noticed traveling at a high rate of speed by Sergeant Jack Westwood of the Highland Heights Police Department, and a chase ensued. So after all this, you probably could have gotten away, but you're driving as fast as possible. Elvis and Sloan. Driving away from this motel as fast as possible. As Sergeant Westwood relayed the information to the dispatcher, he was informed of the Falmouth murders and their possible involvement in the crime. Westwood asked for backup, but before help could arrive, Elvis and Sloan, though heavily armed and facing only one man, decided to surrender. When Elvis was later questioned about this and asked whether or not he intended to kill Westwood, he said yes, but Westwood refused to walk up to the car and as such didn't play fair.
What?
So this is somebody who kills defenseless people, kills people in their sleep, kills teenagers at their own home, but doesn't have a shootout with a cop and instead surrenders when he's faced with a cop and a gun, even though heavily armed and outnumbered the cop.
Paint this picture for me, though. So he's this Westwood, this Sergeant Westwood pulls them over.
Correct. Does not approach their car.
And just sits there. And while they're just sitting there, they surrender.
Correct.
What kind of fizzle out business is this?
Yeah. You thought they'd go out in like a blaze of glory?
Or just continue running.
Yeah.
You could have just sped off.
Yeah. It's kind of wild about it.
What if they were just like dog tired? Maybe. All the adrenaline's gone. They've killed a bunch of people. They've drank. They're probably sobering up. And like they're like, you know what? I've been to prison. I was just at prison. Let's screw it. Let's just turn ourselves in. Mm-hmm. Could have been that simple.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah.
Or else why do it?
I don't know. Elvis.
Chase is like, that doesn't end like that usually. It's suicide by cop. It's a burnout speed chase where the car goes off the road. It doesn't happen.
No, this
like
was
that.
Like the lights of the cruiser went on and they were like, all right, party's over.
We did it.
Elvis was really trying. So they're caught, right? And then they are obviously interviewed right away that night. So within a few hours of them escaping, less than 12 hours of them escaping, they're caught and brought in for questioning. Elvis was really trying to put the blame on himself, essentially saying that he went crazy, he did all the killings, but that his victims pushed him to do what he did. A common theme with him is that each victim was told, quote, just be quiet, I'm nervous, I'm tired, don't give me any trouble. But each victim, according to him, completely ignores those instructions. And instead, even though they're held at gunpoint, they get aggressive with Elvis, which is what pushes him to kill each one. Which is, I think, is like we've said, complete BS.
Yeah.
You know, Reverend Barnes runs at him. The daughter runs at him after she's been unimaginable things happen to her. She's running at them. The people at the hotel, quote, get smart with him. And that's one of the reasons why he had to handle it. Something about how he asked them for the keys to their car. They're like, I'm not giving you my goddamn keys to my car.
I'm not giving you shit.
Exactly. And then they're, you know, at gunpoint, they're saying that, which I just find highly unlikely. He backs down immediately when confronted by police.
Not even confronted.
Yeah, right. Elvis tries to place all the blame on himself to save Sloan, but keep in mind, Sloan did all of the driving. He never attempted to leave the Barnes house or escape from Elvis.
Or help.
He held a gun on the family at one point. He admits to that. And his semen, as well as Elvis's semen, was found at the scene at the Barnes house.
Fry him.
He's definitely a participant in all of it. But this is what's really interesting, too, is that also keep in mind, up until this point, Elvis nor Sloan have committed murder before. Elvis definitely has a rap sheet from the FBI that includes aggravated crimes like assault, armed robbery, rape, but not murder, at least not that we know of. Sloan is 10 years younger than Elvis and has only been charged with grand theft auto up until this point. Elvis mentioned several times in his retelling of the night's events that he knew he had a life sentence hanging over his head and that he was on borrowed time and that this was probably the last night of freedom. He tells police later, quote, I didn't know him at the time that we were in federal lockup. I don't think the man knew how much time I had. I don't think he realized how desperate I was. And I don't think he really realized the full extent of it until I got a gun in my hand. And I don't think he wanted to say anything to me to make me mad. I don't think he wanted to object too loud. But he also said, Elvis planned to kill Sloan once they left Kentucky. He told police, would you leave someone alive to rat on you?
Say what you want about the guy. He's evil, obviously, but he's pragmatic. You know, all things can considered. The whole giving up at the end was kind of strange, but he doesn't talk like a lunatic. Like in his transcripts, he doesn't talk like a crazy person. He just talks like a... don't know.
He's kind of rambly. I hate him, of course.
Of course, but...
So, just a few months after...
It's important to know why he did it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's got to be more than just, they got smart with me. Someone that's never had a single murder to his name goes out and kills five people in one night. Like, that's got to be understood better for future purposes, right? Same for In Cold Blood. Baffled people for 50 years. It's important to at least try to understand why the hell someone would do that who's never done it before. He's not a serial murderer. You know, it's not like some crazy pathology. It's like, why on earth did you do it? You've never done it before.
Well, it's back to our original point, too, that people snap. And that is frightening. You know, that some people are capable of snapping to that extent is very... And I think this was, again, like so many true crime murders that people focus on, is it was all of these wrong factors all coming together all at once. He was on borrowed time. He had a life sentence. He knew if he was... I mean, this was all added extra bonus. Might as well... You know, he'd never killed someone before, so maybe he's always wondering what that felt like. Maybe... And then he's drinking heavily. And they're nervous. They've got to figure out a way to get out of there. He's working with somebody who he doesn't know if he can trust or not. Both of them are.
It started with the Reverend, right? The Barnes patriarch.
Correct.
He was the first murderer.
He was,
murder,
he was shot in the foot first.
But yes. He was the one that was killed first.
According
to Elvis.
Elvis doesn't actually... What's very interesting is that the police don't... I don't know if interrogative techniques were just different in 1973 than they were even 10 years later in 86 with like Fran Root and the Turpin murder. Like they wanted details, like chronological details. But the transcripts in 1973, at least with Elvis and Sloan, first of all, they interviewed them together.
What?
Yes, which is really unheard of. They had them together and then... They had Sloan talk first, and then Elvis was like, don't tell him anymore, blah, blah. And they both waived their right to a lawyer, give complete confessions. And then Elvis is like, don't tell him anymore. They want to get both of us when really it's just me that there only one of us has to go down, and it's going to be me because I know that I did it all. Elvis says all this.
Huh.
And they didn't harp on details. Like, they didn't have like a lot of evidence yet. Like, they didn't have autopsies and things like this, but they weren't like, which one was first? Who did you kill first? Why did you drag them to the bathroom? Like, all these questions that we have.
So we really don't know.
No, we don't, because Elvis ends up killing himself 3 months after this.
What?
Yes. So Elvis, in February of 1974, just 3 months after the murders, he sets fire to his own mattress in his cell at the state penitentiary. And even with burns all over, like 100% of his body, he still doesn't die for 2 days.
Oh, God, that's a terrible way to go.
And it was one of like 4 or 5 different suicide attempts while he was being held in the state. So he was like gung ho on, I'm not going to serve out this life sentence. I'm planning to kill myself.
You don't think it was grief involved too?
He, at one point, there was a police officer who was transporting him somewhere who went on the record as to say that Elvis did admit that he felt bad that he killed 6 people, but he knew that he'd never go to trial, that he knew that he would die before that. And all he could get was life anyway, and he was already serving 1 life sentence. At this point,
was there a moratorium?
State of Kentucky did not have the death penalty.
Really?
Correct. So he was like, I know that I'm not going to be able to get the death penalty, so I'll just basically give it to myself. But he did admit, not grief, but like he felt sorry about it.
Then he's not if he killed himself, I guess he could have killed himself because he was scared to serve out an entire life term, I guess. But I don't know why, if he's not a psychopath. I mean, he is a psychopath.
Oh, he's a total psychopath.
He's not a sociopath.
He's not a sociopath.
He wanted to help Sloan not take the rap for it. Yeah. A sociopath would lie through their teeth the whole time trying to blame Sloan for everything.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not caring at all about that.
Sloan is still alive, by the way.
Is he really?
He's serving out a life sentence in, at the state penitentiary. He was convicted for the rape of Francine Barnes, robbery, kidnapping, and aiding and abetting Elvis in his murderous rampage.
Wow, you can be charged even though you're also a criminal with the other criminal and aiding and abetting that criminal?
I guess so.
It seems like double dipping, kind of.
It does. Like, you're a criminal and you helped this other criminal.
Interesting. I can't believe they would interview them together.
Yeah.
That goes against every, even back then they would have known, well, they're going to cheat out, you know, they're not going to be truthful if they're both here together. Like, it's so much more useful for an interrogator to have them separate. Surely that was well known then.
But here's another part of this suit. Like, your whole point of like, well, he's not quite the psychopath if he felt bad about it and killed himself because he felt
bad. Not the sociopath.
But he also admitted in front of Sloan, well, I was going to kill Sloan the second that we got across the state line. Like, that's
true. I mean, that's pretty psychopathic. Yeah. But I just don't get it. Why would he not, why kill himself? It's very strange. It's a cool question because it's like, maybe he's someone that we've known at one point and he went on to kill six people. And still either felt grief for it or felt a sense of honor enough to be like, I did all of it, not Sloan. That's creepy, man. I would prefer it if he was just all around bad. But to have those little small glimmers of humanity within his story, you're like, I don't like that. I just want you to be the purebred bad guy.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
It ruins it when he's like, oh, no, that's what I would do, too. If like, that's the honorable thing to do is take all the blame since you did all of it. I don't like that.
I don't either. Like, if you're going to be bad, you better be all bad.
I know.
That was my point at the beginning.
It scares me more when you're not all bad.
At the beginning of the episode is that, like, when we can start to see ourselves in things is when things go awry in our heads. We can't make sense of it because we can see ourselves in Sloan and Elvis in some ways, right?
Totally.
Like, who hasn't been, like, running from something that they don't want to be, you know, caught with? Like, you know, you've done something accidentally or on purpose that you don't want to be caught, and now you're having to, like, frantically think of what, you know, like, maybe when you were a little kid
made
or
a snap decision out of anger, like, totally, that you were like, oh god, I shouldn't have done that,
right? And so we see ourselves in people up to an extent, but then beyond that, you know, we're kind of appalled, and in our heads and in our conscious we have to deal with that juxtaposition of the two.
Totally. And we always tell ourselves, I'm not like that. I would never be like that.
Yeah.
Oh, you're also not running from the law with a life sentence over your head kind of thing. Like, Lord knows what you might do.
Same thing with, like, all those cults. Everybody's like, I would never join it. Well, neither did all the cults.
Totally.
Like, you don't know it's a cult sometimes until you're, like, knee deep in this group that you really believe in. And then you're like, oh my God, this is a cult.
And you're real put upon and, like, depressed.
So do you want to hear about the one surviving member of the Barnes family?
The poor mother.
Yeah. So her name was Mary Agnes. And what's really cool about Mary Agnes, or at least what's really cool about, well, so let me back up. What's really cool about having a podcast that covers stuff in the Lexington area is that we have listeners who are, like, just fabulous people who follow us, obviously listen to what we say, and then like write in and respond. And so there's one listener that we've had who knew Mary Agnes very well. They were family friends with Mary Agnes and with the Barnes family. And so I was able to get to talk to them just recently about their experience. And so,
my God, was that like,
it was amazing. It's like, we just have, there's more and more people writing in to the email address for the podcast, and more people, like, message me on Instagram. It's just so fun. It's like the whole reason why
that's great.
I wanted to have a podcast in, because it's like, you're putting out all your weird thoughts in this weird podcasting world, and then you're finding like-minded individuals, and now I'm starting up these, like,
nothing better than that
conversation. It's just so fun. It's like having your own little corner of the world where, like, all these people get together and we can just, like, chat about these, like, obscure things. Mm-hmm. So it's just fabulous. And I'm not going to use their name just because, you know, out of privacy and respect for that, but they are a lovely person, and they told me a lot about Mary Agnes Barnes, who was also a very lovely person. Mary Agnes came home, that she was in Louisville for, they were Episcopal, the Barnes family. She was at an Episcopal conference for that night, and then obviously comes home, and her husband and her two teenage kids had been murdered. And I don't know too many people that could survive something like that. I'm having problems myself even wrapping my head around and, like, attempting to even have empathy for something like that, because I've never had grief that's come anywhere close to something like that.
Yeah, especially like, you are the exact same. That story could be about you. As creepy as that sounds. You
have
the exact
same
demographics at your home.
Yeah, I do have a boy and a girl. That's a really good point. Yeah. This person that was talking about Mary Agnes went on and on about her just morality and disposition. Such a good person. Very, very kind to everybody around her, including this person's mom. Took care of this person's mom and this, you know, when she didn't have to be. Like, really went above and beyond to be such a kind person to people around her. She grew up, Mary Agnes grew up fairly wealthy. I think that that's where a lot of, like, you know, the Barnes house that this all happened in is a large, beautiful ranch. It's 6,800 square feet. So if you know anything about real estate, like, that's a good sized house, right? It's got this full blown basement and this first story, this like giant walkout porch. And it's a beautiful area. They also had like a really great art that including either this person couldn't remember whether it was a Rembrandt or a Renoir, like a famous piece of art. Yeah. Which was apparently like harmed in the process of all of the, what had taken place that night. They were members of Idle Hour Country Club. They sent their kids to Sayre. So like this was a well-off family. Again, and interesting that it didn't get the media attention because it was a fairly wealthy family that this happened to. After this had happened, Mary Agnes really blamed the house itself and said that the house was too accessible. It was fairly remote. And also, you know, it was like a, you know, this one story, it had this basement or whatever. But what was interesting is Mary Agnes then moved in town into somewhat near Henry Clay High School. And built her own duplex basically up on stilts, very high,
very unaccessible,
exactly. And it was kind of known as like this fortress. They believe that it's still there. It's near this four-way stop near Henry Clay High School. But she really built this in reaction to the break-in, a fortress, you know, and you had to get up to it via an elevator.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a very an interesting.
Well, that just makes me so sad.
Yeah, but here it is really sad. Here's
she's like
thing.
Scared, you know. Like,
yeah, she did get married though. She remarried.
Good. My God.
And they would often like they would go down to Florida quite frequently, and so I think that she tried to move on as best she can. A really interesting story though that I just cannot stop thinking about this part of the conversation when me and this person were talking about Mary Agnes is that Mary Agnes died not recent, but maybe like 5 to 10 years ago, I want to say. So once Mary Agnes had died, she had very specific requests in her arrangements for her funeral. And she really wanted there to be this hymn that was sang or at least played in some way, which is called It Is Well in My Soul. And it comes from, it's a really sad story where the original writer of the hymn, a guy named Horatio Spafford, it was written after some really traumatic events that Spafford himself had faced. Something about how he was about to go across the ocean. This is in the 1800s, 1873, I believe. And he's about to cross the Atlantic Ocean, but he has to stay behind. And so instead he sends his family, his wife and a few daughters on this ship ahead of him. And then he plans to join them in like a week or two time. Well, the ship sinks. So he would have been on it, but instead he survived to have to deal with all of this grief. And obviously Mary Agnes saw a lot of herself in this. Well, this Horatio guy goes on to write a really famous hymn called It Is Well With My Soul. And the lyrics, or at least the most famous lyrics, say, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to know, it is well with my soul. So like...
acceptance.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of like Job from the Bible.
Oh God, like the worst story in the Bible?
Yeah, like God is going to take things from you because...
for no apparent reason.
Or maybe he's testing you, or maybe it's because he thinks that you can handle it, or maybe, you know, like, the Old Testament God was a pretty wild God.
He's a wild guy.
He's just, like...
party animal.
Never knew what he was going to do, you know?
So pissed. Just pissed.
Pissed. But... that like it reminds me of that.
That's,
like,
that's a beautiful connection.
Like Mary Agnes, who by all accounts was an absolutely wonderful, lovely person, and then had to deal with that
and
in
very,
her
and
life.
Clearly,
like,
very strong.
No
in
one
faith.
Deserves that. It's. I feel like we just said this about the Turpin murder. No one deserves that. Yeah. But these people, least of all. So what was interesting was the Episcopal priest was like, "Oh, well, this is not. This is a Protestant hymn." This is not an Episcopal thing, but they overlooked it completely for Mary Agnes.
Oh, good.
Because Mary Agnes was Mary Agnes.
She deserved it.
Yeah, and was apparently, you know, deserved to have that, you know, it is well with my soul. So she's buried with her kids and her first husband, which was Reverend Barnes. Hmm. Yeah. So I think I'm going to step away from true crime again. Like, this one was hard.
I'm sure it was.
And I think I got halfway through and I was like, oh, now I get why this didn't get the recognition.
It's just so ugly.
We just hateful and unnecessary and random and psychopathic and completely heinous. And yeah, we're gonna jump back into some history next episode.
Right on, I'm in.
Okay. We're gonna talk about duels.
Duels?
Duels.
Lexington, here in Lexington?
Yes, Lexington was known for dueling.
Between politicians or anybody?
Oh my gosh, anybody. And yeah. My favorite / least favorite thing about duels is that if you were challenged to one, you had to participate or else you were considered a complete...
Yella.
Yes, and you couldn't like go out in public. Huh. So you either showed
shunned.
Up... You either showed up to die, right? Or you didn't get to go out in public ever again.
I know we're going to get into this the next episode, but let me ask you just one question real fast. With the duels... would there have to be a grievance, or can I just be like, I don't like that guy's face? Hey, Bill, I'm challenging you to a duel. Or have to be like, you slept with my wife, Bill. I'll see you at sundown.
Definitely the latter. Mm. And also, what was really interesting about it too is that like it would be in like the papers, like blah 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 says he's challenging it because of this and this. So then everybody in town, it was like gossip, would get to decide one way or another if they believed it was okay to be challenged to that duel. Like, well, I'm on his side. I think that he had every right to challenge him and blah blah blah. And then you also get, you have like a second in command. Your like lieutenants, so to speak.
It's your second
mm-hmm. who tries to reason with the other guy's second. Uh-huh. So there's at least a moment to be like, all right, let's try and rest this a little bit before we get wild here. But yeah. Most of them.
What are the stipulations to all this?
Exactly. Yeah.
First blood or death. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. I cannot wait.
Yeah, it'll be good.
Research that shit, sis. I cannot wait.
Well, there's some good duels in Lexington because you know,
really?
Yeah, there. I mean, this was a time when Lexington is so old.
It's kind of a frontier town at one point,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely a frontier town. Yeah. Very like almost wild, wild west.
Yeah.
Wild, wild Athens of the west.
Pinky in the air.
Forgive me. All right, love you, brother.
Love you, sis.
We're back to our regular format next week, which is always Lexington history, news, and local recommendations. We'll discuss famous Lexington duels, recent headlines, which includes maple syrup and marijuana, and local restaurant and movie recommendations. The Lexington Podcast is produced by Erica Fries and Jonathan O'Hare in association with Fries Media. All original music by Jonathan O'Hare. Email us anytime. We love it. At lexingtonpodcast@gmail.com or catch us on Instagram. We're Lexington Podcast on there as well. As always, if you enjoyed this show, we'd sure appreciate a kind rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're on. Or even better, if you'd like to recommend us to a family member or friend who also loves Lexington or Kentucky history like we do, we would be forever grateful. Special thanks to our sources this week, which include the Lexington Herald Leader and Kentucky Bloodbath by Kevin Sullivan, which, by the way, is a solid read for any Kentucky true crime fans. I recommend it. We found our copy on Amazon. Have a great week.